This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. Coming to you live from the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. It is the third week of February, and this week the Democratic candidates stopped being polite and started getting real. It was like there was all this pent-up anger, and they were hiding it in the previous debates, and on Wednesday, something just snapped and it exploded. All it took was swapping out the billionaire on stage. We are going to devote a lot of today's show to the winners and losers and losers and losers and losers of the debate. It's Las Vegas. On average, if you go, you're going to lose. But first, before we get to that, I want to talk about some things that have been happening in Washington. The president is very upset. He's upset about some things that the government has been doing, his own government, and he's been taking unusual measures to assert control over prosecutions. We know from news reports and from Attorney General Bill Barr's own statements that he's intervened in multiple criminal cases of interest to the president, including directing a change to the sentence recommendation for the president's friend, Roger Stone. On Thursday, Stone was sentenced to 40 months in prison, though there is a motion pending claiming that there may have been a juror problem that could entitle him to a new trial. Trump has intimated in any case he might pardon Stone. He's also expressed his rage that the Justice Department has not prosecuted his enemies, including former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe. To talk about that, I want to bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner on the right. On the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. And our special guests today are Kelly Goff, columnist of the Daily Beast, and Gustavo Arellano, KCRW contributor and features writer at the Los Angeles Times. Hello, everyone.
Hola.
Good evening.
So, Tim, the president has called himself the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, which is not true. The attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. And there's normally this expectation that the president will not intervene in individual cases, especially those involving his associates. Republicans just a few years ago were outraged that Attorney General Loretta Lynch even had a conversation with Bill Clinton on an airport tarmac at a time that the FBI was considering whether to recommend charges against Hillary Clinton related to her email server. Were those Republican concerns about process all disingenuous?
There may have been partisanship going on in Washington, D.C., Josh. there's two things to keep in mind here. I don't think Donald Trump has ever really understood that he's no longer running a small business. When he ran the Trump Organization is not a shareholder-owned company. He got to do with it whatever he wants, and I think that's a lot of the way he sees the federal government. On the other hand, there are two other ideas that really matter here. One is the unitary executive. Donald Trump's not the chief law enforcement officer insofar he's not the attorney general, but the attorney general should be understood to be an appendage of the president. So the Constitution makes it very clear. Article 2 begins that the executive power resides in the president. So that's sort of what is his right. As a conservative, I think
it's his power.
So there's a difference between what he has the power or the legal right to do and what he ought to do. And around the attorney general and the whole Department of Justice is this weird thing where it definitely works for the president, but we kind of want it to be independent. But it's not independent. It would be a bad thing if we had cops, if we had the Federal Bureau of Investigation not be responsible to the president, because then they wouldn't be responsible to the public. So it's particularly upsetting that if he's abusing this power, but we can't say, oh, the DOJ needs to be totally independent of the president. That would be undemocratic.
Well, but this is the role that norms are supposed to play.
Yes.
I mean, and that system has mostly worked, that you have unwritten rules, or sometimes, you know, rules written in regulation, they're not in the Constitution, about what the president ought not to do. And the president has blown up those norms. It's not clear to me the Republicans in Washington care at all about that, even though it seems like that was what was making the unitary executive workable.
Well, yeah, the Republicans are afraid of battling Trump. But another thing that gives him room is the fact that you look at, I mean, Rod Blagojevich. I wrote about his corruption a ton. That massive sentence he got when he got pardoned and commuted and set free, that was way overboard. There's a lot of overzealous prosecutors. There's a lot of judges giving too long of a sentence. There's a good case to be made that the recommended sentence for Roger Stone was way too long. So all these sort of abuses and misdeeds by the DOJ makes room for Trump to do what he's doing.
Gustavo?
I would always assume, though, that if it's a public official that's getting indicted or charged for corruption, you want to set an example for these people. There are the people who erode democracy, whether it's Blagojevich, whether in Orange County, where I'm from, the former sheriff there, Mike Corona, got sentenced to 10 years for one count of witness tampering. And the judge at the time said, the reason we're doing this is because you are betraying trust in the democracy in the process of Orange County specifically. So I agree, especially with a lot of prosecutors, they overzealously over-prosecute folks, especially people of color. But when it comes to public officials, I would assume most people want the book thrown at them, just again, to set that example.
Oh, Kelly? Oh, sorry, I thought you were gesturing. Liz, I want to ask you, because we get a lot of comments from left, right, and center listeners, and some of them don't think you care enough about these abuse of power issues. Some of them voiced that on Twitter. You may have seen this.
I've seen a bit of that.
Yes. Do you want to clarify, is this important if the president is, you know, telling the attorney general to go easy on his friends?
So, yes, it matters. There's a little bit of dispositional stuff going on there where I'm a mellow kind of gal. and then secondly, so much of this administration, and I think this form of conservatism that's ascendant right now and that, you know, is embodied in Trump, is about triggering the libs, right? Liberal hysteria is the goal, right? So it is at least as important as whatever the objective is when crushing the norm or breaking the law or whatever. Getting liberals to react hysterically, getting them to freak out, that is part of the objective. It's good for conservatives politically when that happens. It helps them to impugn the media as being ridiculous and in a permanent state of overinflated Trump derangement syndrome. I'm very sensitive to that. And so I intentionally, try to keep my panic well calibrated, to when it's actually called for. That all being said, it's obviously an issue when the executive is interfering with the judicial system. I think that there's only so much that being upset about it can really do at this point, especially since we've moved on from impeachment. Impeachment, it terminated like the rise of Skywalker, right? It happened, and then everyone just shut up about it instantly because you didn't get a real explosive ending out of it. I think that my energy is mostly on 2020 at this point. I think that is extremely important. So that's where I've redirected my passion.
I know Liz is being a little bit tongue in cheek, but I think she actually nailed it, which is, I think, unfortunately, part of why the impeachment crashed and burned so hard for Democrats is in part because there had been so much, there's almost like Trump fatigue. Trump crazy fatigue. And that's different from Trump derangement syndrome. I think this is a different condition, different medical condition, where it's that the moment he got elected every week, it was, oh my gosh, he said something even more insane. Oh my gosh, he said something even more racist than what he said 72 hours ago. How is this humanly possible that by the time we got to something, really the worst thing he's done, which is to hurt the bedrock of our democracy in terms of being a corrupt president, people kind of shrug their shoulders. I mean, I can't repeat Monica Lewinsky's tweet, but it's worth Googling. I can't say it in front of a family-friendly audience. But she essentially made a joke about what it took to get Bill Clinton impeached, what he was impeached over compared to what this president was not impeached over. And I think there's a lot of blame to go around. I think part of it's the media coverage of feeding into this idea of the hysteria that, oh my gosh, he did something else nutty at Mar-a-Lago today, that by the time we actually got to the meat of an issue all of us should really care about, people didn't care as much as they should have. And that's showing up in the polling, Josh. I mean, even among Democrats, there was sort of a shoulder shrug that impeachment didn't go as planned. And it's actually not even having the result that I thought it might in terms of lighting a fire, that if he wasn't impeached and thrown out of office, that might be the thing that really motivated Democratic voters, and not just Democratic voters, but voters who just don't like him, possibly letting Democrats reclaim some of those independents. That's not showing up in the data. It's just not.
The thing I worry about this, and I think you're right, that like it's important not to look nuts. And also, aside from political strategy, I think a lot of people are just exhausting themselves, spending every day being, you know, being frustrated about things the president is doing that they have no control over, and some of which are not that important. But at the same time, if he has this strategy of basically, you know, throwing everything he can against the wall so that people can't, don't have the resources to object to the things that are actually important, it makes me wonder. I mean, part of me feels like, you know, he's a completely unique personality and persona. Other people can't really replicate this model. They have yep. some innate sense of shame. They don't have the showmanship that he has. And so
you
maybe
put that very politely.
Right. And so maybe this, you know, this may all just pass. But I mean, like, Tim, I just go back to what Republicans said before this presidency. I mean, Republicans would talk about the importance of the rule of law mm-hmm. for a number of reasons. It's not just about fairness. It's also about, you know, if you want an economy where people will invest and grow businesses, you want people to think that, you know, the government is going to treat businesses equally. It's not going to apply the law in a capricious manner based on which billionaires the president has feuds with. And so, I mean, you have a president who has, you know, has ordered the Justice Department to appeal rulings that failed to block the AT&T Time Warner merger because he's mad about coverage on CNN that AT&T owns. It looks like he had the Department of Defense award a defense contract to Microsoft instead of Amazon because he's mad about the Washington Post, which Jeff Bezos owns. I mean, you would think that conservatives would be worried that in the long run, that undermines the prosperity in the American system if you have this sort of crony capitalism where yep. the president picks and chooses either businesses owned by his friends or uses the powers of the government to punish his enemies in business.
So particularly, I think, among conservatives, we should be worried. There's a saying in Washington, the scandal isn't what's illegal, it's what's legal. And you used the word norms earlier, and that is the thing that, as conservatives, we worry about. That, and I see it on Twitter, where if I criticize the president, I say, he really shouldn't have gotten involved with this Ukraine thing because it affected Biden, even if it were a legitimate investigation. And I think what Biden's family is doing in Ukraine, I think it's totally corrupt that his son got that job. But you sit it out. And you sit it out because if you're Trump and going to run against Biden possibly, because it's not because it's illegal for him to necessarily get involved. Again, the unitary executive, the president has the ability to do it. But we need to make sure that there's a distinction between what's illegal and what you ought not do. Because one of the things as conservatives we worry about is A, that government's going to get way too big and be outlawing everything and mandating everything, and B, that we're going to lose moral standards. So you're exactly right, that conservatives should be extra sensitive about Trump trampling on this. But I am just going to say, a lot of the media freakouts about Trump are totally unfounded. I mean, you had one of your colleagues at the New York Times saying, Trump is now becoming the judiciary because he was pardoning people. It's literally one of the clearest presidential powers to do that. So these irrational freakouts about Trump really do make it so that he can get away with anything.
I mean, also the new architecture standards for federal buildings, which were supposedly fascist.
He's now a Nazi because he wants columns on the buildings, yes.
Liz, does this experience undermine the socialist project at all? Which is to say, I mean, you broadly would give the government more power than it has now. And sometimes people like Trump are going to win elections and be put in charge of that apparatus. I mean, isn't a lesson here with the government going so astray in various ways that maybe the power of the government should be more limited?
Well, I mean, so this is like a question about sin, essentially, right? It's like, with people being inherently bad, shouldn't they be totally disempowered? And I think to myself, like, well, no, they should be obedient. And so, I mean, there are a lot of ways that you can accomplish that. And you can do that with, you know, all kinds of controls. But I would say this. I'm not only a socialist, I'm a democratic socialist. So that's what I'm calling for, like, widely distributed power that stems from, you know, sort of big movements. It would mean giving more power to workers in their own businesses. They can have councils, they can have unions. There are lots of ways that socialists distribute power that don't come directly from, like, a centralized state. That's one way to bake that cookie. There are other ways. And then I also think that, you know, one thing we don't talk about with Trump very frequently, but that I think socialists are better at getting at perhaps than liberals, is that liberalism, liberal democracy only works if you have liberal-minded people in it. This is something that's pretty explicit in most theorists of liberalism. Rawls essentially gets around this by talking about language. He talks about public reason, but your language just reflects your thinking, right? So you need liberal-minded people to make liberalism work. And if you get someone who is, you know, has a little bit of an ur-fascist in them, then yeah, it's not going to work. So what socialists are really good at is sniffing out fascists. We dislike them more than anyone, right? Who took Berlin? The Reds. So, I mean, I think that that's very important. And mindset and mood are extremely important. And I think socialists historically have been very, very sensitive to that.
What do you all make of that?
But I don't think that it's so much that he's a fascist. I mean, I was reflecting on a conversation I remember I had.
A
little fascist. I was reflecting on a conversation I had with a friend who was a former Navy SEAL, and I remember he was talking about, we got into this conversation, it was a group of us, about like the most terrifying people to do hand-to-hand combat with and to actually, if you're fighting. And he said, you know, people were kind of throwing out the types of people that in movies you would think is the most dangerous person. And he said, no, it's the crazy person. Because you're trained to predict the move, the next move of someone when you're, if you're just in a fight with someone else who's a soldier or whatever, if someone is utterly insane, you can't predict at all what they're going to throw at you. And so he said that's the most terrifying type of battle to be in, with someone that just, you know, straight out is nuts. And that's what it's like dealing with Trump, in that I don't think Republicans know what he's going to do next. I don't think Democrats know what he's going to do next. I don't think his staff knows what he's going to do next. And I think that because of that, it's everyone's a little bit paralyzed to try to predict what's the best way to deal with him and to move forward, which is, you know, I think I've kind of taken a little bit of Liz's attitude, which is I just try not to be on Twitter very often and to really, you know, curate my news consumption, because I actually like having low blood pressure and being able to sleep at night. And the first couple years, that was really hard to do. I mean, I think when you use the term norms, Josh, you really nailed it, which is no one expected to have, in the same way that no one had to receive an email when they got their ticket for this show that said, remember to wear clothes, right? No one had to be told that. I think a lot of us were caught off guard, again, including his own staff, regarding where he was starting from, you know, in terms of the norms that he would need to be told, you can't do that. The list is so much longer than I think anyone predicted, that that's why we're here. I mean, I just think, you know, that's why we're here.
Well, and so, and another area where that happened just this week has to do with the intelligence community, which is to say the president was apparently outraged about an intelligence briefing to members of the House Intelligence Committee who learned about intelligence, saying that Russia is acting again to intervene in the 2020 election. Trump, when he learned about this briefing, fired the acting director of national intelligence. He then appointed a close political ally of his who has pretty limited intelligence experience. This is Ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell.
That's putting it politely. I've been on air with him many times. You were very kind in your description of his knowledge.
Yes, fair. Anyway, he's the new acting director, that guy.
Great, I feel safer already.
Yes. And so, I mean, again, this is legal. The Vacancies Reform Act lays out rules about Rick Grenell has been confirmed by the Senate to a job to be ambassador to Germany, and the president is allowed to sort of move him around like a chess piece and make him acting director of national intelligence. But again, I mean, the norms, well, there are rules, first of all, set out in the Constitution saying that the Senate gets to advise and consent over the over who gets appointed to senior positions in the executive branch. And so even though this, you know, Tim, this is sort of working through a loophole, and the president has done this over and over again in a lot of positions, avoiding Senate control, Senate confirmation over positions. Again, you know, I mean, aren't conservatives supposed to be worried about the erosion of Article I powers of Congress that are supposed to constrain the president in certain ways?
Yeah, I mean, for one, I think that it's wrong when people say Congress is a co-equal branch of government. My interpretation of the Constitution is Congress is really the boss, and that the executive gets to do what Congress tells him to, but the president's in charge of the executive. On the other hand, we know that Obama appointed people who did recess appointments because he couldn't get enough Democrats to vote for some of his nominees in some of these cases. Obama appointed as a Leon Panetta to run the CIA, a political operative, basically. Tom Donilon, who is a Fannie Mae lobbyist, who has been basically a spokesman at the State Department, was made the National Security Advisor. So both of those appointments are probably better than Rick Grenell.
Right.
But again,
right.
But you see the path being paved. And I was one of the people who said Obama shouldn't use the recess appointment power because he doesn't want to expose Democrats to an uncomfortable vote, which is something that he did. So then when, you know, the crazy guy who's throwing, you know, who's throwing ninja stars at you in the middle of a fight, Trump shows up, you've got to say, well, now we kind of regret some of the norm breaking before. And so then as a conservative, I'm worrying, oh, gosh, so when we get Bernie, what norms is he going to break then? And Liz is now smiling because she's going to take all my property from me and distribute it to all of her friends.
What president, though, hasn't broken the norms? Really, when it comes to appointments and all that, they have every right, at least they will push every right possible to appoint the people that they want. It happens. And at the same time, their party is going to give them excuses. So while Obama was doing something that you disagreed with, of course the Democrats weren't going to say anything. And now with the Republicans, when Trump is doing something, the exact same thing that Obama's doing, of course the Republicans aren't going to do anything. And especially with Trump, he has shown that he is going to appoint people that he finds 100% loyal to him. When they have 99% loyalty, they are out.
But can I just say, everyone's always worn clothes. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's been a bare baseline in terms of norms. And we know that because just this week, the Deputy Attorney General under George H.W. Bush said, wait a minute, you know, condemning Barr. And you had Justice Roof, who runs the Federal Jurist Association, who's calling she was appointed by President Bush, who's calling an emergency meeting because she said, wait a minute. And then you have all of the former U.S. attorneys from Kentucky, who are also not liberals, who are saying, wait a minute. I mean, the baseline has moved so far that I'm not really sure how we even reset, you know?
Let's take a break. You're listening to a special Left, Right, and Center recorded live at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. I will be back with Liz Brunig, Tim Carney, Gustavo Arellano, and Kelly Goff to talk about the Democratic debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guests are Kelly Goff of the Daily Beast and Gustavo Arellano of KCRW and the Los Angeles Times. So who here watched the Democratic presidential debate on Wednesday night? Yeah. Ooh, it's pretty awkward. I do want to play a little bit of a refresher so everyone can relive the awkwardness.
To talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
My foundation, the person that runs it's a woman. 70% of the people there are women. In my company, lots and lots of women have big responsibilities. They get paid exactly the same as men.
And I hope you heard what his defense was. I've been nice to some women. Mr. Mayor, are you willing to release all of those women from those non-disclosure agreements so we can hear their side of the story?
We have a very few non-disclosure agreements.
How many is that?
Let me finish.
How many is that?
None of them accuse me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like the joke I told. And let me put... There's agreements between two parties that wanted to keep it quiet, and that's up to them. They signed those agreements, and we'll live with it. What a wonderful country we have. The best-known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What'd I miss here?
Well, you'll miss that I work in Washington, House 1.
That's the first problem.
Live in Burlington, House 2.
That's good.
And like thousands of other Vermonters, I do have a summer camp. Forgive me for that. But where is your home? Which tax haven
New
do you
York,
have your home?
New York City, thank you very much. Yeah, right, and I pay all my home. Taxes. And I'm happy to do it because I get something for it. And let me say, I thought the senator next to me was half right. I agree we should raise taxes on the... No.
But you're staking your candidacy on your Washington experience. You're on the committee that oversees border security. You're on the committee that does trade. You're literally in part of the committee that's overseeing these things. And we're not able to speak to literally the first thing about the politics of the country to ourselves.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb, or are you mocking me here, Pete?
I'm saying that you shouldn't trivialize that knowledge. I made an error.
People sometimes forget names.
So let's talk about the major policy. Next question. Hello.
I do have to respond.
Come on, man.
I wish everyone was as perfect as you, Pete, but let me tell you what it's like to be in the arena.
Mayor Buttigieg really has a slogan that was thought up by his consultants to paper over a thin version of a plan that would leave millions of people unable to afford their health care. It's not a plan, it's a PowerPoint. And Amy's plan is even less. It's like a post-it note. Insert plan here.
I should note, as I have previously, that my husband is a professional Democratic political fundraiser, and his business this cycle has included raising money to elect Pete Buttigieg. I want to be clear. This was the best debate. Debates are for fighting. Primaries are for fighting. That's how we find out how the candidates are different. It's how we find out who can stand up to attacks in a general election. To do that, you need the candidates to fight. And of course, right at the center of that fight, as you saw, was Mike Bloomberg. Kelly, how did Mike Bloomberg do in that first fight?
Okay, I'm going to admit something that I probably shouldn't, but I'm going to do it anyway, and I hope you all don't judge me. So I was late getting home and was catching it mid-debate and then was going to watch the rear, which I did. And I was trading emails with someone who said, how do you think Mike Bloomberg's doing? And I said, well, so far he seems fine, because I'd missed the first 20 minutes. And then I go on Twitter and I'm like, what I missed. And so when I went to watch the beginning, I obviously had a different perspective than I did when I came midway through. The New York Post cover said Black and Bloom. I thought that was, you know, hat tip to the Post for their creativity. They weren't wrong. I think what I was thrown off by is kind of watching those punches land on him, particularly about women. It reminded me a bit of when Kamala Harris fell flat on her face regarding her criminal justice record. Your weakest points are supposed to be the places where your team preps you to have not one great response, not two great responses, but at least five ways to punch back or at least defend yourself. And I think that's actually what I was more surprised by. Look, I'll be honest. I covered, you know, Mayor Bloomberg quite a bit, especially when I was working for The Root. I wrote a lot about stop and frisk and critical of the policy for a lot of reasons, which I'm happy to get into. But, you know, the thing that was to me most glaring about him when he got in this race is, you know, Mike Bloomberg's a good businessman. He has $1 billion. I don't. He was never
$61 billion.
Oh, forgive me. You know, he was never considered a good politician, and he was never considered, frankly, a people person. And I don't just mean like he's not, you know, a great retail politician. I think a lot of people in New York politics wondered if he actually liked people. I mean, being around people, and that sounds like maybe he didn't realize how much that actually mattered when you're running for president. In New York, it actually doesn't matter so much whether you're nice. Like, actually, I think New Yorkers, I think New Yorkers actually kind of like an edgy, gruff, you know, that's why Giuliani, Bloomberg, they want people who are going to get stuff done. They're not looking for a hug. The thing is, when you're running for president, you know, to some degree, they're trying to elect a hugger in chief. And Donald Trump is not that. But let me say this. He likes being around people, at least when they're telling him how great he is. I don't think that Mike Bloomberg actually even wants to be around people who are telling him how great he is. He just doesn't like interacting with people. He wants to go in, do policy, do business, and leave. And that I never saw this as being a good arena for him. I'm actually surprised he's doing as well as he is, but I think that can be explained by the $400 million he's spent so far.
But I think he was even worse than that, which is to say, I mean, the problem proposition was with Bloomberg was supposed to be sort of what you lay out, that like, no, he's not personable or nice. We don't need nice. We need someone who can take the fight to Donald Trump. But he didn't really take the fight to the people in this debate. He was sort of, he was, you know, he was kind of like, you know, flippant, but he was also kind of whiny. He didn't seem eager to make the case for Mike Bloomberg for president.
No, he's the worst combination of smug and wounded, right? I mean, so like, he's completely self-assured that he's the most intelligent person. He's dripping with disdain for a bunch of people who have been in politics for a long time. And he's angry that he's having to explain himself, right? I mean, he was extremely taken aback that he was being treated like a candidate and not like a billionaire for once, right? This is not how politicians react to billionaires behind closed doors. So this was probably his first experience, having people talk to him when they weren't trying to get him to donate to their campaigns.
But again, it shouldn't have been a surprise. He was on stage with Elizabeth Warren, who, to paraphrase Liam Neeson, has a very specific set of skills. Taking down Wall Street rich guys is her main skill. It's what she does best. It was a supercharge to her to be on stage with. It should not have been a surprise. He didn't, and again, he really hasn't faced tough races before. When he won those races and then rigged it so he got to run a third time, he didn't have these tough races. And yeah, people suck up to billionaires. So he was totally unprepared. So if you're a Democrat and you're looking for somebody who can beat Trump, he did not show you that he could do that.
I just don't think he cares at all, especially when it comes to debates. This is really going to be a test, more so than Trump. Can someone buy their way into the White House? $415 or whatever million dollars that he's already spent. He has the poll numbers as high as he has. And then if his poll numbers go down after this debate, that shows that the American Democratic voters are smart. If it doesn't, well, there you are.
I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters.
Really? Because this was the most watched debate so far, about 20 million viewers. The third most watched primary debate ever in history. The first two Trump debates outrated it. But otherwise, I mean, you know, people saw him fall on his face.
Still doesn't matter, because it matters to every other person on that stage. They needed a solid performance, because if they didn't have a solid performance and their poll numbers don't go up, they're not going to have enough money to keep going. He has enough money to go as long as he wants to. And I actually wonder if his poll numbers fall, just on principle because of his ego, I actually think he'll be even more incentivized to stay in the race. And part of what I wonder is, I actually think it might even be worse than feeling disdain for having to talk to the politicians. I actually think, you know, he didn't check his watch like George H.W. Bush did in the middle of a debate. But it was the same sentiment, which is that he just didn't want to be there. I think that, and his strategy so far has been, I don't have to debate, I don't have to campaign, I'll just flood with airwaves. It's been working. He can go as long as he wants to, and it's possible that he feels disdain for these candidates because he believes he should only be facing Trump.
So, Tim, I want to talk with you about a column you wrote that I thought was maybe the harshest thing I've seen written about Mike Bloomberg in a period when people have written a lot of very harsh things about him. Can you lay out your case that he, like, does not care about humans?
Yes.
Or dogs. Did you see him shake the snout of the dog?
That might have been a pro-dog thing. I don't know.
Weird.
But so the case that Bloomberg is sort of anti-human is that you look at, some people think, oh, on the one hand, he treated the women he works with so poorly. On the other hand, he's really funding Planned Parenthood and all that stuff. On the one hand, he likes capitalism, but on the other hand, he supports China's communist government. The common thread through all of these things could be he doesn't really, and you could say he doesn't like people. I'm going to put it in sort of a Catholic term. He does not respect the dignity of the human individual. We Christians see that every individual is made in the image of God and has infinite value, and we're supposed to treat people as a means to an, as an end in themselves. Bloomberg treats people as a means to the end more than anybody else. And so when there were women in his workplace who got pregnant, he got really angry at them. That baby was getting in the way of this woman's productivity. I laid it out in that column, but I really do think that the unifying thread, if he looks right here, left here, center there, et cetera, I think the unifying thread is that he sees people as means to an end and not ends in themselves.
I would say most billionaires, though. That's why you become a billionaire, because you'll take every little person possible to get one more $1 billion.
I don't know. See, I don't see Oprah Winfrey that way. I think that how people actually
look at American Dirt.
Well, she should have run.
Yeah.
But I think this is over the top. And I think this gets to, well, you know, I think Bloomberg had a very bad night, and I don't think he's going to be the nominee. I think here's the silver lining for him. Like, Mike Bloomberg, his philanthropic efforts focus around gun control, climate change, smoking cessation, and, you know, and public health. It doesn't seem like what you would care about if you didn't care about humans as ends in themselves. I mean, what is the means to an end that he's trying to achieve by getting people to stop smoking and getting people not to shoot each other with guns? I mean, is that just about business productivity? It seems to me that he's an authoritarian in a lot of ways, right. And he thinks that, you know, the government knows better. But I do think that he does things that indicate that he cares about people and that have drawn positive reactions from the public and from a lot of office holders. I mean, I realize he's thrown around a lot of money, and that has really helped him a lot with Democratic officials, but there's also, I think, a sense that his philanthropic efforts have been effective and his political efforts have been effective, and they've been effective at achieving positive changes for people. And so I think that is, then when he goes into the debate, and obviously there are a lot of really excellent arguments against him in the debate that he dealt with very poorly, but the manner of the arguments I thought was sort of reminiscent of what you saw, I mean, with Kamala Harris on her criminal justice record, with Joe Biden on whatever he said in the 70s or 80s, where it's sort of like, you come in and now because he's in the way of these other people who also want to be president, suddenly he's history's greatest monster. And I think there's a better history's greatest monster argument about him than there was about Kamala Harris mm-hmm. or Joe Biden. But because this has been the mode in a lot of these debates about, you know, taking somebody's record and painting it as so completely horrible, that I wonder if people are a little bit inured to that, that like, oh, he's the new guy and he's being hazed a little bit. I wonder if that undermines the criticisms.
I think some of the authoritarianism does, again, have to do with not respecting people's right to make choices of their own. And again, you know, smoking and guns, these are not popular things in a lot of the country, but the idea that you should be able to make your own mistakes is a fundamental American thing. And that also has to do with the nanny status technocratic mindset does have to do with not respecting the individual dignity.
Except the reason I actually agree with him on those issues is because it does have such an outsized effect on the rest of us in terms of both cost emotionally when you lose people to these issues, but also financially, you know, especially when you don't curb smoking or obesity, particularly the impact on the African-American community when it comes to all of the health ramifications of hypertension and diabetes. But, you know, it's interesting. I actually don't know that Mike Bloomberg is a terrible person. I don't know him well enough to make that assessment. My criticism was more of him as an elected official and as a candidate. And part of why I, again, did not see him making a great presidential candidate is exactly what you touched upon, which doesn't get enough coverage, which is how he literally bought himself a third term as mayor. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings someone once said is that the dream of America only works if people believe that there are certain things that cannot be bought. And that's really...
Well, but the people of the city of New York elected him to that third term. If they were so bothered by the third term. Well, like, he moved mountains and used a lot of his money to do it, to change the rules so that he could seek it. But it was approved by the public.
But which is, I think, what this election has actually become about, right? Which is what our core values are as a country. I think I could have answered that question a lot more clearly, I thought, you know, before 4 years ago. But, you know, if you'd asked me 4 years ago if Americans would stand for the idea that someone could steal a presidential election, I would have said absolutely not. Like, they'll put up with politicians who are hypocrites and who cheat. They won't put up with that. Would they put up with a president, you know, who engages in corruption and tries to intervene legally on behalf of his friends? I would have said absolutely not. I actually, one of the reasons I'm curious to see the polling after this debate, where Mike Bloomberg clearly did not have a great night, is something that I'm starting to hear that I've been surprised about from older people I know who don't live in Los Angeles or New York, which is what you used to hear about is the candidate you like, you trust, you respect, particularly on the Democratic side. You know, you talk about the beer test, right? That was always the test. I've started to hear some language shift from people I've been surprised about, which is, I don't know, Bloomberg seems kind of nasty. I feel like he could handle Trump in a debate. I used to not hear that type of, like, language, but it's interesting that even some of the people who I know who like Joe Biden, the language that they've used is, he doesn't seem like he has the fight left in him that he would have had like a few years ago. My point being that no one picked Barack Obama because they thought he looks like he'll shank someone in a debate. That wasn't the, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yet this is where we're at. So that's why I'm saying I'm really curious to see what comes out of the debate. It could be that people are like, He had a terrible performance. He's not worried about the primary, but he got under Donald Trump's skin, which is why he mentioned him in the Hannity interview. And Donald Trump is allegedly still mad about the speech Bloomberg gave at the Democratic convention 4 years ago, where he made fun of him. And so, you know, that could be something that's more appealing than actually someone who people think is right on the issues and has the right legislative history.
Speaking of having the fight in you, Amy Klobuchar, she really dislikes Pete Buttigieg.
Can I tell you, by the end of the debate, I did too.
Gustavo, they fought about Mexico, at least nominally, sort of. This was a large number of minutes to issues about Mexico, although I'm not sure how deep the minutes were. What did you make of that exchange?
I feel for Amy. I really do. Look, I don't want to be stereotypical, but she's up in Minnesota. She's probably should be concentrating more on, I'm forgetting his name right now. Who's the Prime Minister of Canada? Trudeau, of course.
Yes.
You know, instead of the President of Mexico. And I think actually it was a Freudian slip on her part. Maybe she's nervous about being called out on immigration because she did it twice. She couldn't remember it in the original interview with Telemundo. And then when she tried to say it during the debate, she mispronounced it. She said López Obrador instead of López Obrador. And on one hand, but then on the other hand, you have you know, he's going after her. And then out of nowhere, when they start talking about DACA recipients and documented students or documented individuals who came to this country as kids, he starts talking in Spanish. The whole narrative with DACAers and Dreamers is that they came to this country when they were young. They're culturally American. They're going to be speaking English, Pedro, like not Spanish.
it was sort of funny, though, in that the two of them have been basically fighting over white voters. Like
centrist voters, Midwest voters, they're both trying to almost parlay their Midwest nice into, hey, that's why we're electable, that's why you should vote for us. And then they just came out nasty. Oh, my Lord. Like, just brawlers. If you know Midwesterners, they are very nice, but you don't want to get in a fight with them at all. But
no, the subtitle of the debate should have been, I have a black friend and a Latino friend.
And a Latino
and a
friend,
Latino
too.
Friends. And, you know, just the list goes on because, you know, it was so glaringly obvious there were no people of color on that stage, but people kept finding a way to bring every response back. What do you think of climate change? Well, you know, those women of color, great. What do you think of Donald Trump? Boy, he's been terrible with those women of color. If you guys are looking for someone to vote for, because, you know, I just want to make my pitch. It was interesting.
Well, it was interesting. That was especially from Elizabeth Warren, I think. I mean, is there someone else you're referring to? And so,
the first questions, even Bernie, the opening questions and statements were all people found a way to work in. Because, again, it's an important part of the Democratic base. I'm actually not a registered Democrat, but, you know, all of my family, you know, are. And if you want to have a viable shot, particularly in these Southern contests coming up Super Tuesday. But what I thought was interesting is that most of the people left up here didn't exactly have, you know, gangbusters records on issues of racial justice or equality. A lot of them didn't even talk about those issues until they decided to mention it in the opening statement. So,
but the reason that they're on this stage and Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Julian Castro are not is that these are the candidates who had support from black voters and Hispanic voters, at least in the polling. I mean, we've seen.
You mean in New Hampshire and Iowa, Josh?
Well, no, and in the national polling. I mean, you qualify for these debates through polling,
I got it.
You know, Kamala Harris would still be in the campaign if she was rolling up black voters like Barack Obama.
You know, she and other people might still be in the campaign if Iowa and New Hampshire didn't go first.
Well, I also want to talk about healthcare. This debate, like a lot of the debates, had a big fight over healthcare. It was in Nevada in the context of this powerful union, the Culinary Union, that has its own health plan. The union fought hard for. A lot of people in the union don't want to give it up. Liz, is the debate over this academic? Because you heard two messages from Bernie's opponents in this debate. One of them was Bernie's plan is going to take away your healthcare plan. The other message was Bernie's plan is politically impossible because it can't pass the Senate. It feels like those two are contradictory messages. So which is it?
Right. Well, so one is this is going to happen and it's going to be bad. And one is, well, it would be great, but it can't happen. and they seem to be trying both of those. I hear a lot of there's no way this could possibly happen, so it's not even worth worrying about. I think if that were the case, Bloomberg wouldn't have gotten in. He got in to stop Bernie. He doesn't want his taxes to go up. right? He likes having 60-something billion dollars and being able to decide he wants to purchase a third mayoral term or whatever.
What Bloomberg would say and what he did say in the debate is that he thinks Bernie will lose the general election. So his official position is he's not worried about what Bernie
That's
will do.
So kind of him. He's worried about a Republican winning because he was a Republican for decades. Poor baby. Big change of heart. I know he must be terribly worried about what would happen if Trump won again. I mean, he only has 60-something billion dollars under Trump. What if he had even more? Trump's presidency has not been hard for Bloomberg. It's not been hard for billionaires. It's been good for markets and good for capital. He's worried about Bernie getting in there and doing something. That's what he's worried about. Bloomberg would lose to Trump. Trump is meaner than Bloomberg. Bloomberg is also a black hole of charisma. Trump is not. Trump would crush him. For one, Trump's like twice his size, and the sheer look of it on stage would be comical. Trump also is funny, and Bloomberg has no sense of humor because he's so mortally wounded about even having to justify himself. Anyway, he would be crushed instantly by Trump. Trump would win 50 states. I mean, it would be a complete bloodbath. Right. I mean, on healthcare, is it possible? A lot of things are possible. I mean, if you actually listen to Bernie's team talk about this, they do have a story about how it would happen, and it involves a lot of parliamentary procedure stuff. Right? I mean, like, you can't ram single payer through budget reconciliation, but you can get pretty close.
If 50 Democrats line up with you to do that.
Right. And I mean, I think there is the argument that if Bernie were the president, it would be very hard for Democrats to run against him, and they would need to depend on him for reelection. So you would see some getting in line happening there. Right. So, we can put on the table, it's a possibility. Remember, 4 years ago when people would laugh about Trump winning? Lots of things are possible in American politics that people never thought were possible.
Still with me are Kelly Goff, Gustavo Arellano, Tim Carney, and Liz Brunig. And now it is time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Kelly Goff, what is your Tweet of the Week or your Tweets of the Week?
Well, this week, George Zimmerman announced that he was filing a multimillion-dollar defamation suit against Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg for their tweets having the audacity to commemorate the tragic death of Trayvon Martin. So in honor of that, I decided to read their tweets. Pete Buttigieg tweeted, "Trayvon Martin would have been 25 today. How many 25th birthdays have been stolen from us by white supremacy, gun violence, prejudice, and fear?" Elizabeth Warren tweeted, "My heart goes out to Sabrina Fulton and Trayvon's family and friends. He should still be with us today. We need to end gun violence and racism, and we need to build a world where all of our children, especially young black boys, can grow up safe and free."
Gustavo Arellano.
So right now, of course, President Trump is trying to build a border wall down in Arizona. So a lot of reporters are down there. New York Times Southwest correspondent Simon Romero put up this tweet. I'm going to read it. "Cut a saguaro down in Arizona, you get arrested. But work crews building the border wall now destroying the protected cactus, which can live for 200 years, longer than Arizona has been part of the United States. This was a scene today on the border near Sonoita, Sonora, so you just see a chopped up saguaro. If you've ever driven down I-10, you see how beautiful those cacti are. They are a symbol of the American Southwest. I get Trump wants to build his border wall. Leave the saguaros out of it. The saguaros never did anything to him, unless he feels insecure in front of them. I don't know. Just leave him alone."
Tim Carney, what is your Tweet of the Week?
Is Mexico really sending us their best saguaros?
Good. So after the debate in which Bernie sort of forswore his least pleasant online followers, Keith Ellison gratuitously, the Attorney General of Minnesota, gratuitously tweeted out, and sort of absurdly, "I have never seen Bernie's supporters being unusually mean or rude. Anybody who's on Twitter probably has. Can someone send me an example of a Bernie bro being bad?" Again, a very odd request to make. He got lots of replies. "Also, are we holding all candidates responsible for the behavior of some of their supporters? Waiting to hear." He was flooded with responses from people who could show them, you know, the Twitter handle with a little rose and some misogynistic or very angry comment. But the most on-point one came from Congressman Steve Scalise, who was shot by a Bernie Sanders supporter, who said, "Yes, I can think of an example."
Liz Brunig, what is your Tweet of the Week? For the radio audience, can you narrate a little bit what people are laughing about on the monitor?
Yes. If you enjoyed the, I believe, 1995 or 6 Radiohead album, The Bins, then you might have enjoyed Michael Bloomberg making a very similar face of what looks like total defeat during the debate. Let's hope it sticks.
My tweet comes from my friend, Toby Murashanu, who says, it's weird how my two favorite candidates are Pete and Amy, and I'm pretty sure Amy's first executive order would be firing Pete out of a cannon into the sea. You are listening to a special Left, Right, and Center recorded live at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica with Tim Carney, Elizabeth Brunig, Kelly Goff, and Gustavo Arellano. Coming up, the possibility that this Democratic convention is going to be a real mess. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guests are Kelly Goff of the Daily Beast and Gustavo Arellano of KCRW and the Los Angeles Times. At the end of Wednesday's debate, the moderators asked a question to all 6 candidates. Should the Democratic convention nominate for president whoever comes into the convention with the most delegates, even if that person does not have an absolute majority of the delegates? This looks like an increasingly likely scenario. 538's primary forecast pegs the odds at 41% that no candidate will win a majority of the pledged delegates. And if that happens, 5 of the 6 candidates said no, you should not necessarily nominate whoever comes into the convention with the most delegates. You should let the convention delegates deliberate and pick the nominee that they see as best. The one exception was Bernie Sanders, the candidate 538 thinks is most likely to actually have the most delegates. He said whoever has the most delegates should be the nominee. Liz, is there really a first principles answer to this question? People want the candidate they want to be the nominee. They take the position on this matter that is convenient for the situation they're in. Is there an argument that, you know, that you can say from first principles that an answer here is right?
Right. I mean, so like the simple Democratic argument is the best representation you have of what the American people actually want is that first ballot vote, right? The most people voted for this person. That's why they have the most delegates. It's not a majority, but it is a plurality. And so it represents, in, you know, very simple democratic terms, what the greatest chunk wants. And then on the other side, there's a huge strategic vulnerability here in trying to broker a convention, which is if Bernie does come in with a plurality, that's because he's got a pretty big base, right? Or at least a significant chunk that the Democrats will need to vote in the general. And I sincerely believe, based on the, you know, way the Bernie constituency is responding to rumors of a brokered convention, that if you get a brokered convention, Bernie comes in with a plurality but not a majority, but he winds up not being the nominee, you will have a lot of people sit out the general. They will feel like the DNC stole it. They are Bernie or bust. And they will not vote. And I mean, there's nothing you can do about that because they already don't like the Democratic Party. So scolding them is just going to make them more recalcitrant.
Well, also, but they did this 4 years ago. That's why we're here.
No, they didn't. They did not. No, no, no. Hillary can't blame that on Bernie. That is not what happened. Bernie people voted for Hillary at greater rates than Hillary people voted for Obama.
That's not what the data shows.
That is what the data shows.
No, it's not.
Right? Bernie did more events for Hillary than Hillary did for Obama.
The data shows that there were just enough people who went third party who were disenfranchised Bernie or busters.
There were Obama Trump voters. Obama Trump voters gave it to Trump.
And Kelly, when you said this is what they did 4 years ago, I thought you meant the DNC rigged it against Bernie, because
that's
that kind of did
true.
Happen 4 years
that's
ago.
True.
And when they scheduled the debates on Saturdays. And
yep.
I mean, so it would be one thing if Sanders had 40% and 60% of the party just said, anybody but Bernie. But if you look at the polls, that's not actually true. A lot of the Biden, the Warren, the Buttigieg supporters, et cetera, Bernie's the second choice, or he's perfectly acceptable. So if Bernie gets a plurality and then loses at the convention, it's not a matter of the guy with a plurality didn't end up winning in kind of a, you know, a instant runoff, second choice type thing. It will be that the Democratic Party basically stole the election from the guy who had the most votes.
Tim's making points.
Listen. I'm not a registered Democrat, so I cede the floor to the people who are.
I am not a member of no organized party. I am a Democrat. I am. Will Rogers. No, this is what's happening right now. Even with this, with what's happening, the Democratic Party in the past 4 years, especially with the rise of Bernie Sanders, what you're seeing is a circular firing squad. You're going to have such purity. And also coming from, you know, Hillary in her documentary saying, oh, everyone hates Bernie. Is that really how you're going to beat Donald Trump? Like two of the biggest people in the Democratic Party just slugging each other out? No, that's how Trump gets elected easily to the White House.
Well, also, it was kind of ironic coming from her that she's like, people really don't like, Bernie. Yes. I was kind of thinking, like, there's a lack of self-awareness.
I try not to focus too much on Hillary Clinton, and I try to hope everybody else also tries not to focus too much on Hillary Clinton. But I think, you know, this question of Democratic legitimacy, it depends on the outcome. You know, if Bernie comes into the convention with 48% of the delegates and the next closest person has 30%, I think he has a very strong claim that clearly indicates that he had the broadest, deepest support in the party, and he's the one with the most legitimate claim on it. If he comes in with 36% of the delegates and there's someone close behind him with 34 right. or 33, I think it's likely that both of those people can make an argument that, you know, if you gathered up the choices of people behind them, you know, the candidate behind wouldn't have to be preferred by that many more of the 31% that supported some other candidate to actually have the better claim on that. And this is the argument that Elizabeth Warren is rather explicitly making now, saying that she's the unity candidate. I saw polling about, you know, which nominees would Democrats be upset if we're chosen. Tulsi Gabbard tops the list. Almost half the voters say they'd be upset about that. And then you have Bloomberg and Sanders, and down at the bottom really is Warren, I believe tied with Pete, for the smallest percentage who say they would be upset if she received the nomination. And so I think, you know, I think your point is right, Liz, that a lot of Bernie supporters will be very angry if he doesn't get the nomination. But I think that there is risk for him to bleed away support to Donald Trump from moderate voters, especially in the economic environment we're in right now. The president's overall approval numbers have ticked up somewhat. His approval ratings on the economy are significantly better than his overall approval rating. Americans report the highest level of satisfaction with the economy to pollsters that they have in 20 years. And if Bernie is running on an agenda of a revolution and sharp changes in economic policy, it will put Trump in a weird position of being able to be the continuity stability candidate. And I don't think that's going to win over most of the suburban voters who have trended toward the Democratic Party. But I think that also could be enough. And I think that's going to be part of an argument from a candidate like Warren, who's saying that we need a candidate who bleeds off the fewest supporters possible, someone who's progressive enough to get people on the progressive left, and yet someone who also reassures that people who are relatively new to the party. I don't think that's going to be a crazy argument to hear from Warren and probably from some of the other candidates if we have a wide-open convention where nobody's even close to a majority.
Right. So my position on the Democratic Party at this point is there's no unity candidate, right? So if you look at Bernie Sanders voters, they have polled them on this, and they've asked them, will you vote for anyone other than Bernie? They ask all of the supporters of the different candidates, will you vote for anyone other than your number one choice? Bernie has the largest number of people who say nobody but Bernie.
Except, right? I believe, Tulsi.
Right. Well, I mean, those five guys, they're very strong. And they're very, very, very cemented in their support. But Bernie has a lot of supporters, and a lot of them say nobody but Bernie. And you can like it, lump it, or feel indifferent about it, but that's how they are. And so we can look at polling as we go on in the primary. Maybe that will change as we get closer to the general. But that's the situation now. So with that in mind, there's really no unity candidate, I don't think. I mean, and I know that's not a great position to be in, but it just kind of speaks to the moment that we're in. As for Warren, I mean, you know, she's going to be in a similar position if she's elected, which is trying to keep these progressives and also trying not to lose moderates. I think the thing to do with the strong economy is what I've suggested before, which is to be like, look, everything's going great. We're a super rich country. We've got plenty of money. We're doing okay. So why do some people have to suffer so much, right? Some, including like moms, right? Why do some mothers in the United States have to give birth and go back to work after 2 weeks or less? Why do some women have to have abortions, right? Because they can't afford to have a baby and take time off of work, right? We're a rich country. Why should this be happening?
But that argument works on you because you're actually an empathetic human being, and not all voters are. And that's a sad statement of fact. But even when you look, you know, at what motivates certain voters, on the liberal side, there's a lot of empathy. On the conservative side, there's this concept of conscientiousness, which really just translates into this idea of personal responsibility. One of the reasons I'm no longer a Democrat and I'm also not a Republican is because I really felt like on the Democratic side, people make the case that your station in life is never your fault, whereas on the Republican side, people try to pretend your station in life is always your fault. And both philosophies are just patently wrong. It's a mix of luck and circumstance and opportunity and grit and resilience. I mean, you know, that's why I can come from a family of people who picked cotton. Even my mother picked cotton when she was small and then stood up on the stage tonight. It's a mix of things, you know? And so what I saw, so what I have to say is the numbers that Sanders supporters never want to talk about are actually the numbers of the Gallup poll, which has not changed. And they've been doing it for 50 years. When they track political minority candidates, so to speak, to see where bias lies. And every type of candidate Americans have grown increasingly comfortable with, electing a black president, electing a Latino president, electing an Asian president, even electing a Muslim president. The two areas that are still the least electable are an atheist candidate and a socialist candidate. And yet the Sanders voters don't want to talk about that. Now that's fine, because here's the reality. Everyone sitting on this stage, and likely everyone in this room, will be fine if Donald Trump gets 4 more years. The truth is, if I look at my day-to-day life, the only thing that actually changed in terms of my day-to-day life is my film about reproductive rights I'd been trying to get made for 6 years got greenlit the week he won. And, you know, I can't write as much stuff off from my taxes because I'm not a multimillionaire. But in terms of my day-to-day existence, the people who will be most hurt are the ones who are saying they won't vote if they don't get their candidate. And that's what's frustrating. It's really heartbreaking.
We may be a little bit ahead of ourselves here. I mean, right. That 538 model has a 59% chance that someone will come into the convention with a majority of delegates. Gustavo, I was wondering, if Bernie pulls that off, it's probably going to be on the strength of a strong performance in California, including a strong performance with Hispanic voters. What has Bernie done right with Hispanic voters this time around? Because it seemed like this wasn't an area of particular strength 4 years ago, but you saw these caucuses in Iowa in heavily Hispanic areas where he was running up 90%+ of the vote. What happened?
One of the reasons why, especially younger Latinos and people even in my generation, is that Bernie sounds exactly like a Chicano studies professor. Like, he's talking about stuff that we were talking about at Mecha, Chapman University, back in the 90s. Inequity. We got to change the economy. The exchange with him and Bloomberg, where Bloomberg was saying like, oh yeah, you know, talking trash on socialism. And Bernie's like, we live in a socialist society because we've been, subsidizing the military for $20 trillion or whatever. But the more important thing, at least in California, is that the Bernie Sanders campaign is setting up offices in the hearts of some of the most Latino communities in California. And these are places that the Democratic Party historically have completely ignored, especially the candidates. Oxnard, Santana in Orange County, Coachella. No, the last presidential candidate to have visited Coachella, which is, we're not talking about the festival, we're talking about the city of Coachella, was John F. Kennedy in the 1960s, the Eastern Coachella Valley. Bernie Sanders, they not only held Bernie-cella in 2016, he showed up just in December, where the Coachella City Council, 4 or 5 are Latinos, and the one non-Latino married a Latino, they all endorsed Bernie, the only city council in the United States to unanimously endorse Bernie. He is going to places where no one ever has. And then at the same time, you mix both of those together, young Latinos in California, they make up his most enthusiastic constituency by far, to the point where the Public Policy Institute of California, they released a survey this past week showing that 52% of Latinos are siding with Bernie Sanders of California voters in the election. California voters overall, only 32% are going for Bernie. So if Bernie is going to win, he has to go with Latinos. And that's why he's going with them so much.
Tim, should Republicans want to run against Bernie? I mean, clearly, the president does want to run against Bernie, but Democrats wanted to run against Donald Trump in 2016, yes. And here we are. I mean, I think people express excessively confident predictions about how Bernie would perform in a general election. I think it would be very different from a lot of general elections we've seen. I mean, for one example, one thing that has hampered Democrats historically in Arizona and Texas is lower Hispanic turnout than white turnout. If this organizing that he's done in the primary can pay off in the general, that could help him on the electoral map. His theory is that he's supposed to do better in the Rust Belt than Hillary Clinton did. Should Republicans be afraid that Bernie Sanders is going to win, and not only will Trump lose, you'll have a more left-wing Democratic president than you would have had otherwise?
I think your implication is right there. Any Republican or conservative who wants Bernie to be the nominee because they think he's easier to beat, I think is dead wrong. For one, we ought to all be, and again, this is sort of a conservative idea, but very intellectually modest. You can go back and read an article I wrote in 2016 that touches on this. It was headlined, "No, Donald Trump Can't Win." And since then, a lot of us have learned a lesson to not make such strong predictions about who's electable and who's not electable. But also, in Washington, we make a mistake of assuming voters are totally ideological. You're talking about the Hispanic vote. I was just looking at a recent survey that showed Hispanics in California are as likely to call themselves conservative as liberals. Yet there's this heavy Bernie support. What does that suggest? Maybe it suggests that Bernie showing up in the place that they live and talking to them, even if they didn't love their Chicano studies professor, they say, okay, this is a guy who cares about it. It's about identity. It's about class. It's about all sorts of stuff, and says, okay, this guy gets us. And so in that regard, I think if I had to guess now, and again, I'm a little chastened from my 2016 predictions, I would actually say that Buttigieg would be the weakest opponent for Trump to face. In part, he still hasn't found a black supporter outside. and then second, again, I think he is, being so young, doesn't have the ability to reach out and connect on a human level. So Bernie can reach far beyond the left. That's the main mistake, I think, pundits, especially in the media and on the right, make, is they think, okay, only socialists are going to vote for him. I don't think that's true at all, because voters are not as ideological as we pundits are.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Kelly Goff, it's your soapbox.
Well, instead of a peeve, it's Black History Month, and I thought it would be fitting to pay tribute to some of the Black political trailblazers who are rarely recognized. In 1948, Alice Dunnigan became the first Black woman in the White House press corps covering the administration of President Harry Truman. In 1955, E. Frederick Morrow became the first African-American to hold an executive position in the White House, serving President Eisenhower as administrative officer for special projects. In 1961, Andrew Hatcher became the first African-American to serve in the White House press office as associate press secretary for President Kennedy. In 1977, Patricia Roberts Harris became the first Black female cabinet member and the first Black woman to enter the presidential line of succession when she became Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And in 1992, Carol Simpson became the first Black woman to moderate a U.S. presidential debate. I stand on the shoulders of these giants, and this Black History Month, I salute them.
Gustavo Arellano.
A rant against the national media for covering an issue here in California. Today, the California Assembly, they passed a resolution apologizing to Japanese Americans for how the state of California has treated them. We're talking about laws passed against owning land, laws passed trying to get rid of their American citizenship, and of course, what a lot of people call internment camps, but call them what they are, concentration camps. Unfortunately, the national media, all they're focusing on is the internment camp part, or quote-unquote internment camps. Please, American media, note that California is far more racist than just having internment camps in the past, especially against Japanese Americans.
Tim Carney, it's your soapbox.
Thank you. So Kelly suggested earlier that conservatives don't have compassion very well, but it did actually really strike me. I walked a mile to the studio, and the homelessness in Santa Monica hit me hard, and it filled me with a little bit of anger at some of what's going on in the politics here in California. There are many, many causes to homelessness. One of them is not enough homes. California has the most regulated housing industry. They sit under the most restrictions on when and where and how much you can build, and particularly when it comes to multifamily housing. And so California, a state that prides itself on being progressive, on being empathetic, is letting their regulations and some NIMBYism in a place like Santa Monica included get in the way of building what people need, which is more affordable housing. Regulations make us have less housing, and it makes it so that it's only profitable to build more expensive housing. So I plead with Californians and Santa Monicans, let there be more homes and let your homeless neighbors have a roof over their head at night.
Liz Bruning, it's your rant.
I'm partial to Bernie, that's no secret, but nobody who's run for president in the Democratic primary so far has made me as repulsed and as angry as Bloomberg. I'm just one person, I'm just one vote, but I will say this, I have a big megaphone, and I will not vote for Michael Bloomberg if he's the nominee. I will not encourage anyone to vote for Michael Bloomberg if he's the nominee. If the ballot has only Trump and Bloomberg on it, two billionaires, the only thing you can pick is yes to a system where extremely rich people can buy their way into the highest office of a democracy. I will not consent to that.
For my rant, the president has banned residents of New York from joining Global Entry, which is the trusted traveler program that helps people clear immigration faster when re-entering the United States. The argument of the Trump administration is that New York has barred the Department of Homeland Security from accessing New York DMV records that it needs to vet Global Entry applicants to make sure they can be trusted to be trusted travelers. New York, for its part, doesn't want DHS digging through DMV records because they think, quite reasonably, that DHS is going to use that in order to find and deport unauthorized immigrants. But when Andrew Cuomo went to the Department of Homeland Security and offered to make an exception, saying if someone affirmatively applies for Global Entry, fine, then you can see their DMV records, the Trump administration said, no, that's not good enough. We need to be able to see all the records. And they said that because this is not about Global Entry applications. It's about pressuring states like New York to assist the federal government in the enforcement of federal laws, even in the face of controversies in states about whether they wish to use their resources to support the enforcement of those laws. And even though the Constitution is supposed to stop the feds from commandeering state resources in that way. Once again, it shows that the Republican commitment to federalism only goes as far as when federalism supports whatever the Republican policy goals are today. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank our panelists, Tim Carney, Liz Bruning, Gustavo Arellano, and Kelly Goff.
Thanks to our great audience and hosts at the Broad Stage. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our live event was produced by Aaron Sine and the KCRW events team. Special thanks to Steve Chiatakis and Andrew Weiler. Our live event was engineered by Phil Richards. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.